on Straight Talk Africa this week. U.S. Secretary of State Antony Blinken is in Ethiopia and will visit Niger on a two-nation stop in Africa. Later this month, U.S. Vice President Kamala Harris continues the Africa diplomacy as the U.S. pitches a new partnership with countries across the continent. We'll discuss Secretary Blinken's visit and other news in our reporter segment. Also, fear and protests in Tunisia as President Kais Saied cracks down on illegal immigration. Sub-Saharan African migrants are leaving the country in droves. Why are black Tunisians so worried? We'll have an in-depth discussion on the social, political and racial tensions in the North African country. Straight Talk Africa starts now. Hello there and a warm welcome to the show. I'm Heidi Adams. It is so great to be with you. We're going to begin our show with a look at the latest news and developments in our reporter segment. And of course, joining me are my VOA colleagues, Ignatius Annor from VOA's English to Africa News Service and Myra de la Salette from VOA's Portuguese News Service. Myra, Ignatius, a warm welcome to both of you. And Ignatius, I'm going to kick things off with you and U.S. Secretary of State Antony Blinken's visit to Ethiopia and Niger. He is in Addis Ababa right now. What do we know about this trip?
Well, thank you very much, Heidi, for having me. So, like you rightly said, yesterday, Blinken touched down in Addis Ababa, and he met this morning with the Deputy Prime Minister and also the Foreign Affairs Minister for Ethiopia, Demeke Mekonnen, to have a wide range of issues. Number one is to restore trade relations that happened since the two-year conflict in the northern part of the country. Remember that when that happened, the U.S. were critical of the Ethiopian administration. It led to economic and security assistance to the country being cut, as well as the restriction of the African Growth and Opportunity Act, AGOA, which is a free trade, a partnership between both countries, something that the Ethiopian officials have asked that it be restored, as they also seek to ask for support from the International Monetary Fund to shore up its economy. And also, one critical thing that the Ethiopian officials put to Antony Blinken this morning was the establishment of the transitional administration in Tigray, for example. There hasn't been, you know, a government in that part of the country since the conflict 2 years ago, and also a policy that looks at the justice and the calls for justice for the people who were impacted by the war. Right. There have been, you know, humanitarian agencies and aid groups that have been talking about the impact that the war has had on those people and why victims of that conflict are asking for justice. And it's critical to state that at least for the first time, the U.S. government starts with those officials and that conversations were tabled, as much as also how the U.S. can help them to recover from the infrastructure deficit that has, you know, been left because of the conflict. So that's where things are as we speak. He's also expected to meet the Ethiopian Prime Minister Abiy Ahmed tomorrow before taking off to Niger.
And of course, you know, just because a conflict has reached a truce on paper, of course, that doesn't end the consequences for those caught in the middle of it. Later this month, U.S. Vice President Kamala Harris, of course, she also makes her trip to the African continent. What do we know about that trip?
So this will be the fifth time that we're seeing senior U.S. administration officials going into Africa, coming off of the back of the U.S.-Africa Leaders Summit that happened December. It shows a commitment of the administration. Vice President Kamala Harris will be the very first black vice president to visit Ghana. She will be going with her husband, Doug Emhoff, to talk about regional and global issues. Now, Ghana launched the Return to Africa program in 2019 that is inviting African Americans to make, you know, the country and indeed the sub-region their home. And as we speak now, 1,500 African Americans have taken that, you know, that invitation and have resettled to the West African sub-region. The U.S. administration has been talking about how to leverage the African diaspora here in the United States. And so it's critical for Kamala Harris to be there and talk about various issues, including climate mitigation. From Ghana, he's expected to meet President Nana Akufo-Addo to talk about regional issues. Ghana explained a critical role as far as advancing peace and security within the sub-region is concerned. For instance, issues that have been happening on the coastal belt, which Ghana raised concerns about, and the rise of jihadist activities within that sub-region. So Vice President Kamala Harris is going there to really advance those conversations. And then she would also go to Tanzania. You remember that Tanzania has its first female leader, Samia Hassan, who visited the White House last April. And then following that, in September of 2021, we also saw the president of Zambia, Hakainde Hichilema, also meet Kamala Harris at the White House to talk about increasing democratic dispensation. He was a key opposition leader who took office last year when elections were run, and it's increasing the path of economic and political leverage within that country. So that's why Kamala Harris is going to be there. Zambia as well is a key producer of copper, and the U.S. government has been talking about energy and clean energy transition. And so it's sort of courting them to ensure that those partnerships are enhanced.
We'll certainly keep an eye on those. Myra, I want to change gears here a little bit to the conflict in the DRC there, of course, between the government and M23 rebels. Kinshasa claims these rebels are backed by Rwanda. Rwanda refutes this, of course. But what caught my attention is that Angola is now going to be deploying troops to the DRC after a truce that it had brokered failed. Please tell us a little bit about this. How worried is President João Lourenço about this conflict, which is right next door, of course? And are there concerns that this could spread into a more international conflict?
Thank you for having me, Heidi. And yes, President João Lourenço is now in kind of a tight spot because he has been praised by his neighbors, by most importantly, actually, by the Western leaders. We remember in December when U.S.-Africa summit leaders happened here in D.C., Secretary Blinken praised the role of Angola as a mediator for this conflict in the Democratic Republic of Congo. And also, more recently, President from France, Emmanuel Macron, he did say that he had high hopes that Angola would help and actually bring a solution for the conflict. And that was days before the truce was broke, right? And now what we have is Angola deciding to deploy troops.
If not truce, then troops.
Exactly, right? So there are a few things here that we have to look at. Historically, Angola and the DRC are friends. Everything that happens in one or the other country affects directly. We saw during the Civil War the influx of refugees from one side to the other side, which then brought also other kind of problems, as we know. And at the same time, the reputation of the president is also at play here, right? Because he's this champion of the Great Lakes. Right, mm-hmm. He was called that during the past years. He was a champion. So he has this kind of legacy now that he needs to keep up with. And of course, the last resort is bringing the troops. On the other hand, analysts in Angola also say that what is missing here is that M23 has not been called to the table, to sit at the table and have a conversation, actually be part of the negotiations, and that might be where everything is kind of getting this friction of breaking truce the moment they are actually declared.
Myra, my producer tells me I've got a minute 30 here. I just quickly wanted to talk to you about an interview recently that President Lourenço did with European outlet Euronews. He said European nations can count on Angola to help replace Russian gas and shore up its energy needs. Could this cause any problems for him inside the country? And of course, in Angola's relationship with Russia, which of course we know are long held and go back a long way. today.
Yes, and let me start for saying this. President Lourenço gave us an interview in December when he was here for the summit, and we asked him this question of the approach to other Western countries and the relationship with Russia. How would that affect? And he said something, and I quote, that no continent is hostage of any power, and there's room for everyone, end quote. So that to say that he's also changing the Angolan position in the world, in the continent itself. He wants to be different from what he was with President José Eduardo Santos. And this is showing exactly that, is that he wants to build bridges with every destination possible, and he's seeing that it's possible to do it. Also, in Angola, there's this talk that it's now for Angola and Africa in general to play these cards right, because everyone is interested in Africa. So there's a door here, there's a lot of windows, and it's not necessarily only to China or only to Russia. It's for everyone, as long as they know how to play these cards right.
And as the Russian war in Ukraine is going into its second year now, of course, leverage is going to probably be a very important theme. Myra and Ignatius, I wish we had time for that other topic, Ignatius, we wanted to talk about, but I have run out of time. Thank you so much to both of you for coming in. I'll have you back on the show again soon. Thank you so much.
Of course, thank you.
Well, still ahead here on Straight Talk Africa, we'll discuss Tunisian President Kais Saied's immigration crackdown. Hundreds of migrants from sub-Saharan Africa are fleeing the country. Is this all about illegal immigration? Why are black Tunisians and migrants fearful? My guests and I will discuss the situation right after the break.
In times of change, when the world seems uncertain, and what we hear doesn't reflect what we see, we seek the truth. When we are told only part of the story, we lose trust. In moments of crisis, our dreams, hopes, and wishes for a better tomorrow depend on a free press. At Voice of America, we bring you the stories that people take risks to see. We connect the world and unite it with truth. At Voice of America, we show you the whole picture.
Welcome back. Tunisian President Kais Saied has said it more than once that he believes illegal immigration is a plot to change the racial makeup of his country. Saied is cracking down on undocumented migrants and says those who are in Tunisia legally have nothing to fear. Is his rhetoric, though, stoking xenophobia and a racial backlash? Migrants from sub-Saharan Africa are leaving the country in droves. Black Tunisians say they worry they'll become targets of a surge in racist attacks. Outrage on the streets of Tunis as rights groups protest against President Saied's crackdown on illegal immigration. It has had devastating consequences for migrants like Berry Biali Stephen from Cote d'Ivoire. He's afraid to stay in Tunisia.
We were kicked out of the house. We live on the streets. And the streets were still attacked. So this morning we came here to the embassy trying to see if they can help us to return home.
He says problems started when President Saed made controversial remarks that illegal immigration from sub-Saharan Africa is part of a so-called conspiracy to change Tunisia's racial makeup. He has ordered his security forces to expel all undocumented migrants. Sadia Mosbach is Tunisian and heads an anti-racism campaign. She says she's noticed an uptick in attacks on sub-Saharan African migrants and black Tunisians in recent weeks.
We are afraid, like everyone else. We are a little more targeted because we are a visible population. We are a visible and stigmatized population. Today, the fear is that we are targeted because the first step is sub-Saharans. The fear is step two. It will be black Tunisians.
Black Tunisians, like 25-year-old waitress Nebras Mahna.
Some people stopped me in the middle of the street and told me to leave, to go away. I was accused of asking for political asylum. I felt even more fear after the president's speech.
Rhetoric that has drawn international criticism, including from the African Union, which has called it racialized hate speech. President Saed and his government deny they're stoking racism.
It's unfortunate that the African Union Commission made this statement. Really, it is. But I think it will backfire a bit as it is not independent and responsible enough. There is no problem with legal migrants. On the contrary, we want more of these. Illegal migrants are urged to return home, but while respecting their rights and dignity.
That is what these migrants have done. They've given up and returned to the very countries they had left in search of a better life elsewhere. Well, now for analysis on the situation in Tunisia, Intisar Fakir from the Middle East Institute joins me here in studio. She's the director of its North Africa and Sahel program. Also joining us from Lebanon is independent analyst Salah Dean Sartori. Intisar and Dean, a warm welcome to all of you. I really appreciate your time. And I'm going to start here in studio with you, Intisar. When I look at the scenes that we are seeing play out in Tunisia, what the government says is an immigration crackdown. If you're here legally, you have nothing to worry about. If you are here illegally, then you do have something to worry about. What I worry about is the president's rhetoric that talks about the threat of changing or the plot to change his country's racial makeup. That now makes this about race, doesn't it? I mean, is this purely about illegal immigration, or is this about race?
You're absolutely right, Haiti. This is not an issue of illegal migration, because if you look at the numbers, there are a number of different estimates kind of being floating around. One of the ones that's most sort of repeated most often is about 21,000 undocumented sub-Saharan African migrants in Tunisia. Now, that is about 0.2% of the population, which is 12 million Tunisians. So,
and about 21,000 undocumented people,
exactly,
in the country.
So hardly the great replacement theory that Qais Saied is talking about. Plain and simple, this is him trying to find a scapegoat, trying to deflect blame for the country's problems. And he is not the first populist autocrat to blame outsiders, migrants, and minorities. This is what it's about.
Of course, Dean, this brings us to that the question about the youth. You know, we've seen a groundswell of youth protests in the country over the past few years. Dissatisfaction with Qais Saied's rule, dissatisfaction, of course, with the economic situation in the country, which, by the way, affects young Tunisians as well. We've seen them flee the country as well, being migrants in other parts of the world. My question here is, what is the mood and what has been the reaction amongst young Tunisians to this?
Thank you for having me, first of all. And second of all, As you can see, Qais Saied's support in 2019 was overwhelmingly from young people. According to Sigma Polling Institute, 90% of young people ages 18 to 25 came out and supported him. And I can say, even within my own family, young people were very supportive of Qais Saied's actions, and they actually saw it with such optimism. But coming in now, we're seeing over the last couple of years, there's been a large shift, and his support is waning heavily. Especially after these comments, you can see people in the street, specifically young people, taking to the street and showing some a change in their apathy, which has been sort of seen as a form of protest in and of itself. There was a legislative elections in January, and there was extremely low, the record low turnout in these elections. And this has been seen as another form of protest. And now we see Tunisian young people taking to the streets, showing up on Twitter, on Facebook, and especially black young Tunisians who are starting trends, showing their passports and their Tunisian IDs to show that they are real Tunisians. Even then, you see a lot of young people in the diaspora, myself included as a Tunisian American, speaking out against this. This is not something Tunisia stands for, and I think a lot of young people are starting to show that. His support is most definitely waning, and I think it's definitely waning among young people.
Well, of course, Intisar, we all know that this is often a tactic. Shifting blame is often a tactic by politicians whose popularity is waning or have authoritarian tendencies. Please tell us a little bit about the state of Tunisia's economy right now, because this is not the first time that President Saied has blamed another group for the country's problems.
Absolutely correct. Now, the state of the economy has not been in a good place for several years right now. We have high inflation. We have high unemployment. The country is really struggling, and this is pretty consistent, pretty on brand for Qais Saied to essentially look for other people to blame. And what I would say is that when you're looking at the migration situation, Tunisia is not a place where you have a huge surge of migrants or refugees that are creating additional needs that need to be addressed. Tunisia's problems far surpass the question of migration. They're deeper than the question of migration. And, I would say that what is really insidious about what Qais Saied is doing is that he is taking whatever existing hate, whatever existing xenophobia, and essentially giving it a free pass, basically, and using it to, weaponize it to crack down on migrants and to justify the sort of attacks and mob violence that we have seen recently.
Does the country have an immigration problem, though? We say the numbers are relative. They might not be as big as we might see in other places. But is there a problem with immigration policy in the country? Does he have some leg to stand on?
I think a lot of what you hear right now is essentially him trying to appeal to his base, because I think there are a couple of different factors that are important to look at. The question of racism and xenophobia, finding more outlets, finding more avenues, is a global issue.
Correct.
And I think Tunisia is not immune to that. I think what he is, and if you look at, for example, at social media, particularly on TikTok, you'll see a lot of misinformation and disinformation campaign around sub-Saharan Africans and this presumed sort of damage that they're doing in the country. And I think he is calculating that this is something that would play well with his base. And so that's part of his rhetoric. There is an issue where Europe is very much pressuring Tunisia to try and to tighten some of the border security. But what he is also obscuring by saying that this is a sub-Saharan African undocumented migrant problem is that the vast majority of those that are trying to cross from Tunisia through the central Mediterranean route, from Tunisia onto Europe, Italy in particular, are still mostly Tunisians. So it is essentially his failure to try to address the economic situation and to try to address the political situation that he is trying to obscure by blaming sub-Saharan migrants in Tunisia.
Dean, very briefly, it does bring us to this age-old question about the Afro-Arab question, let me put it that way. Do Tunisians, by and large, see themselves as African, or do they see themselves as Arab or Middle Eastern first? What's the national outlook on that?
This is actually a very interesting question. And in North Africa at large, there is an Amazigh haplotype or group or ethnic identity that is under the surface in a lot of Tunisians. Tunisians specifically, if you compare to Morocco, Algeria, to their counterparts and their neighbors, happen to be extraordinarily homogeneous in the identity of seeing themselves as Arab or Islamic in this regard. They have a very small Amazigh minority, specifically in the islands of Djerba and in the south. And those identities, and along with Black Tunisians, have never been sort of identified by the state or by the constitution. And these groups have created post-Arab Spring, have sort of tried to speak out against this. But Tunisians, by and large, view themselves as Arab. And they have actually, there is racism in the country, and this is bringing it to light and bringing in a conversation that needs to be had with Tunisians about viewing how they view Afro-Arabs or Sub-Saharan Arabs or Sub-Saharan Africans in general. Tunisians, by and large, do view themselves as Africans in some extent, but they are more closely, their identity is more closely related to Arabs in this regard. But the question of are they African or are they Arab is something that needs to be had now.
Well, strange enough, my view has always been that many North African countries are African when the World Cup, the Soccer World Cup's on, and then when that's over, then, you know, we have this question again. But I want to ask you about the African Union here in Tsar. We've seen them say this is racialized hate speech. Mm-hmm. The Tunisian government says, unfortunate that you're saying this. So my question is here, what is your assessment of the way the African Union has responded here? But at the same time, what is the responsibility on the countries that those migrants have left in search of a better opportunity, mm-hmm. to not just stand at airports and welcome their people when they've been kicked out of other countries, but to ensure that they don't leave in the first place, that they don't have to go outside the country, just as we see happen in Tunisia as well?
Yeah, certainly. I think the African Union has condemned Tunisia pretty strongly. And I think, to me, really, it's an indication of just how isolated this once friendly, tiny country used to be. And increasingly, they're running out of friends, whether it's the EU, whether it's the whether it's the European Union, whether it's the US. Tunisia is really finding itself increasingly isolated on the international stage, largely because of this president. And I think in terms of the responsibility of leaders, I think certainly a good place to start is ensuring a safe, stable environment for their citizens with some degree of economic opportunity so that, you know, that they don't leave. But I think also we need to remember that migration is a very natural human phenomenon. You know,
correct.
Humans have been moving around for as long as they have existed. But part of the issue when we talk about migration is that it's talked about very much in these terms of fear and sort of
fleeing
fear and sort of xenophobia, rather than looking at it as, you know, potentially an economic issue, where you can look at it as, you know, maybe an issue of supply, and you can try to address some of these issues that drive people out of their homes. But also you have to look at it in more sort of broader economic terms. For example, one of the places that people want to migrate to, Europe. You know, Europe has aging populations. European population growth has been either declining or staggering over the past few staggering over the past few years. And so you don't really hear us talk about migration in these sort of economic terms. How can we make it work for everybody? It's very much about fear and how can we protect our countries and what we have from others.
This is such a fascinating conversation. Please, let's continue it again on another episode of our show. But thank you so much, Salah Dean Sartori and Intisar Fakir. Thank you to both of you for being here on Straight Talk Africa. I do appreciate your perspectives. And that is our show for this week. Thank you to all my guests and to you, of course, for joining us on television, radio, and online. Follow us on social media, and I will see you next time. Goodbye.